everyone's blood, cause it ain't no sense in us trampling on the stones. It's us down, down to the bone. Blood is thick, waters were known well, cousins were kept apart, mothers were often memories. Fathers were not favorites on the farm, for he could do some harm, he could wreck the master scheme, for he, brothers, could dream. Your mama ain't no saint, your daddy died in a shallow stream, but your uncle Dr. King did have a dream, my brother. And what is your real excuse? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school? Free love and sex ain't nothing but a game. Don't never last, try.
Homeboy by Sunji Ali. Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, coming at you live from Skid Row Studios in the Midland Studio with my co-host Earlene Anthony. Our call number is 1-800-893-9562. This week on the... Now, this week on the Qumran Report, we will celebrate the birthday of Marcus Garvey, the father of Black nationalism. Now, I'm delighted to have with us in the studio Bill White, the director of my play about Marcus Garvey, Catch the Tiger, about J. Edgar Hoover's effort to bring down Marcus Garvey. And in the studio with us is my fellow playwright from the Roby Advanced Playwriting Program, Pauletta James, who's going to tell us about her play, A Door for Lizette Marvaux, that's opening in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And also I'm delighted to have with us on the line from Rhode Island, Keith Stokes. Keith, welcome to the new Qumran Report.
Thank you.
Oh, so glad to have you on the line. Let's start off with Keith Stokes, and my co-host Earlene will give us a little introduction.
Keith W. Stokes is a native Newport, Rhode Island resident. Mr. Stokes has served as a Rhode Island advisor for the National Trust for Historic Preservation, along with serving on numerous regional and national historic preservation boards. Mr. Stokes has a long and distinguished career in business, history and community development, with degrees from Cornell University and University of Chicago. Recently, Mr. Stokes has successfully drafted and advocated for a new Rhode Island law that will establish an African American history curriculum for all K-12 public schools in the state.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Earlene Anthony. Now, Keith, how did you begin your interest in the history of slavery in Rhode Island?
Well, actually, it wasn't the history of slavery. I've just always been interested in my own African heritage, and I've just been very fortunate to be able to grow up and live in a community and with a family that ourselves, you know, we're able to trace ourselves back to the earliest days of America. But more importantly, we've been able to pass on to each generation a significant amount of heirlooms and artifacts and that really record the life of Africans in America. So for me, it's always been about, you know, knowing myself. I don't think I've ever really would have received this history outside of the family, certainly not growing up. And it was something that was always based in my family, and I'm now passing it on to as many people that I possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you talk a little about the difference in the selling of slaves in the South and the selling of slaves in the East, especially like Rhode Island?
Well, I think it's important to understand that for most of us, when we tend to think of African enslavement in America, we tend to think of the pre-Civil War Southern antebellum. We tend to think of the South. We think of the cotton plantations, the rice plantations, tobacco plantations. We think of Georgia, South Carolina, Mississippi, Texas. But very few people would realize that the very origin of African trade and ownership was the 13 original colonies. And here in New England, particularly in the 17th century, we're talking about the 1660s and 70s, some of the largest slave trading areas of America at that time was places like New London, Connecticut, Newport, Rhode Island, Boston, Massachusetts, Bristol, Rhode Island, even Portsmouth, New Hampshire. So for many of us, we really haven't realized the fact that if we begin to talk about the beginnings of America and the beginnings of colonial America, at that very early stage, enslaved Africans were arriving, and they were living, they were working, and they were worshiping side by side with European settlers.
Now, I was listening to one of your lectures, and you talked about the fact that they would seek out younger slaves to buy, 10, 11 years old. What was the reason behind that?
Well, you have to understand that I'm here in Rhode Island, and August is our warmest month, but for the balance of the year, it can be pretty cool and cold in New England. We don't have the temperate climate that you have in the West Coast and the South. So for the most part, enslaved Africans were not working on large farms or plantations that were producing what we call the cash crops, the crops that were driving the world economy at that time. Again, tobacco, sugarcane, coffee, rice, all those types of things were being grown and were using large enslaved African labor forces in the southern part of this country, the Caribbean, and South America. Here in New England, you know, for the most part, our farms were smaller. They were more self-sufficient. So for the most part, most of the enslaved Africans weren't really required to work on the farms. Now, they did. There were those that worked on farms, but those farms were mostly animal husbandry, particularly goat and horse raising. Most of the Africans actually worked in the really urban maritime cities and towns of the time. So as an example, if I was to take you back to Newport, Rhode Island, about a third of the population in the years leading up to the American Revolution were African. I don't mean African-American of people of mixed ancestry, but people who were largely from what is today Ghana and Guinea. And for the most part, the types of work that they were involved in was the work that was required at that time. So many of them were working in sail lofts, particularly women. Many were working in everything from barrel making, snuff making. Most of the American rum of the 18th century was being produced in Newport. It was called Guinea rum. And many of the enslaved Africans worked in those rum distilleries. Mm-hmm. What we find is that since most of these Africans were less labor force and more skilled trades, I mean, they were craftsmen, it normally took 5 to 6 years to learn a trade. You would apprentice. My own ancestors were apprenticed as a Windsor chair maker in the 18th and 19th century. So what we find is you normally would select younger Africans, sometimes those younger than 10. And by the time that they were 15, which would have been an adult in 1750, they would have had 5 or 6 years of trade skills, and they would have been a master, again, shipwright, or a carpenter, or a stonemason, or a soap maker. Mm-hmm. So, again, it really is based upon the fact that New England, because of the climate, because of the trade requirements, enslaved Africans were more involved in household or trade service work, whereas the further south you went, with the southern climate, the temperate climate, the demand for large labor force on sugar and cotton plantations and such, you saw more slaves working in those environments. In fact, there's a very old slave saying called sold down the river. And what that means is the further south you went as an enslaved African, the worse your circumstance. Better to be a house servant or an indentured servant in the north versus being on a tobacco plantation in Virginia, which is still better than being in a rice plantation in the Carolinas, but nobody wanted to be in a sugar plantation in the West Indies. So again, it's not better or worse. It's not good or bad. They were still enslaved in New England. They ran away. They were punished. They were restricted in their lives. There were slave codes in New England. But I think what's most important to recognize is that the origins of what we know as American slavery is as much a New England condition as it is a Southern condition.
Mm. Interesting. Now, have you been able to trace the link of the skilled slave trades to some of the modern-day families that's in Rhode Island today?
It's hard. It's difficult. One of the challenges with our heritage and history is that at some point, so many of us being chattel property, We didn't have control over our primary records, birth records, tax records, property records. We couldn't own property. So it's always a challenge sometimes to trace. Many times you're relying on oral history. What we find is that oral histories is much more accurate than some scholars would tend to believe. And once you connect that oral history with common sense and primary records, what we did had in Newport, which is very unique and very important to recognize, and it's related to and it influences later a Marcus Garvey, a Martin Luther King, certainly a Malcolm X, a Harriet Tubman. In 1780, for the first time in the history of the Americas, a group of African men come together in Newport. This is 1780. And they form and charter the Free African Union Society. This Free African Union Society had three very important purposes. One, they would take as much records of the Africans in Newport as they could possibly collect. So they took birth records, death records. In fact, later they would form the first free African school. They would oversee marriages. Most importantly, when they became free, many of them would revert back to African names and customs. Mm. So this African Union Society in Newport is the first of its kind. Later we see it in Philadelphia. We see it in Providence, Rhode Island, Boston, Massachusetts, New York. But it begins in Newport. The records of this society, which go from about 1780 to about 1830, still exist. We have their minutes. We have their discussions. We have their list of members. We have the names of children, their children that are in school. So one of the rare things that we have here in Rhode Island, particularly here in Newport, are these early, early primary records. We're taking these records, and we're now comparing them to some of the transit of these Africans and later their involvement into African-Americans. Mm. The challenge, again, is there's always gaps. And to be quite candid, there's sometimes so much of a focus on the slave trade that we tend to forget that the focus should be less on the institution and more on the people. My grandmother used to always remind me growing up, slavery is how we got here, but it tells you little to who we are as a people. Mm. So my interest in the type of scholarship that I try to embrace is to recognize the slave institution, the brutality of it, and its influence on the tens of millions of Africans who arrived to the New World. But my real focus and what I'm trying to uncover, what was it like for early Africans to live, to work, to worship in early America? And most importantly, the creative survival that allowed them, despite enslavement, to persevere. In fact, some of the earliest black churches in what we know as the black churches in America are really established as much in New England as they are in later on in the South in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. So again, my goal is and my focus is to understand the concept of slavery, but to really focus on and ultimately bring to public light the story of the Africans themselves and later African Americans. Because again, what I have found over my years of public presentations, particularly kids of color, I can't tell you how excited they get when you start talking about early colonial history, and you're not talking about George and Martha Washington or Thomas Jefferson. You're talking about African and later African-American men and women that looked like them, had names that they could recognize, and did things from either music, through the way they worshiped, the way they worked, the way they danced, that they could identify with today. So for me, it's so important for us to share this history that binds us together as African people. Well, and again... Mm-hmm. Here in Rhode Island, we're so fortunate to have so much primary and secondary supporting information.
Let me ask you about, can you talk a little about the historic slave cemetery that's in Rhode Island?
Well, it's an interesting, it's an African cemetery. It has both enslaved and free Africans, later African Americans. It is what we believe and most scholars believe is the oldest and largest existing enslaved free African cemetery in America. Now, it's important to understand what we mean by that is it dates back to 1705. We have several hundred markers that still exist of Africans who were born and lived and died in the 17th and 18th century. But what's most important is that where those markers, how they were carved, what's set on those markers, and the people who were buried beneath them are at their original location. It wasn't a case such as the African burial ground in New York, which is phenomenal, but that was a case where they discovered this burial. but they really don't know who the Africans were. They, through DNA tests, they know they're men, they're women, where they might have originated from, their age, their death. But what we have in our cemetery, combined with the records of the African Union Society, we have deep information about who was buried, when they were buried, what their lives were like. And in some markers, and this becomes important, the Africans actually carve on the markers where they're from in Africa or from the West Indies. And what gets very exciting for us is, if you've ever gone to an old cemetery, an old colonial cemetery, and sometimes you'll see on the top of the tombstone an angel, or what they call a death head, which represents in Christianity that resurrection, that you die and you'll be born again with Jesus in heaven. Hmm. Well, what the Africans did in Newport, which you will not find anywhere else where early African cemeteries and markers are, is that in many of the markers, they actually gave the features African features. So we have angels that have curly hair, that have full African features. And again, these are markers that are in 1770, 1750, 1780. Mm-hmm. Well before the ending of the Civil War, well before the Emancipation Act or the Civil Rights Act. These were Africans nearly 300 years ago who were entirely focused on building an identity and a remembrance of their existence in early America. So it's a phenomenal cemetery. We've created a website called colonialcemetery.com, and we've taken every surviving marker, there's about 300, mm-hmm. and we put a digital image. And then we put a whole background of information about either the person in the marker or a background on slavery in Rhode Island, free Africans, men and women. There's a lot of discussions about their marriage rituals, their dining rituals. Many of the Africans owned their own homes. Here in Newport, we have several dozen colonial homes where Africans lived and worked in, not as slaves, but as free men and women who owned those homes. Mm-hmm. So for us, it's important to take this information and again, present it from the context of slavery. That's how we arrived here.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you
but
this.
It's the creative survival is most important.
Mm-hmm. Now, Keith, can you talk a little about I saw you was developing a program relating to the slaves' emancipation in Jamaica. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, that was something that came by. I've had the ability over the years to lecture and to work with a number of the Caribbean islands. I've been to Bahamas, I've been to Barbados, Dominican Republic, but I hadn't been to Jamaica, and it's ironic for me because actually one of my maternal ancestors was a part of the largest emancipation effort in 1795 between Jamaica and America, part of the Barclay family, which is Barclays Bank. And in that, there were 30 Jamaican slaves who were freed. One was a boy named October. His name was changed to Robert Barclay. He was brought to Philadelphia in 1795, and he's my direct ancestor. And in fact, every generation going forward to my children, we have all their records and information. So one of the things that we've been doing is talking to professors at the University of West Indies of reconnecting the story of these Africans through this family. It's very similar to Roots.
Mm-hmm.
But what's most exciting is that being from Newport and having this connection, I've been able to connect not only Jamaica as a place where slaves originated, but now we're connecting Jamaica with Philadelphia, with Connecticut, with Rhode Island, with America. All of a sudden now, we're able to retrace the diaspora of Africans. And that's what's very important because, again, this is what Marcus Garvey believed in, and this is what he tried to establish with the Universal Negro Improvement Association. He believed that all of us across the world in African heritage had a connectivity. I mean, that's what's so phenomenal with Garvey. We're trying to do that today by identifying with people of African heritage who could be from Rhode Island, they could be from California, they could be from Jamaica, Barbados, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Charleston, South Carolina. We all have a connectivity here.
Mm-hmm. That's very. Go ahead.
The strength of that connectivity gives us the ability to parlay that into political power, educational power, economic power, because those original 10 million that somehow survived and made it to the new world were all the offspring of them.
Mm-hmm.
And because of their lives and deaths and efforts, we have the opportunity today to repay them by building a stronger African identity and heritage. That was the essence of Marcus Garvey. that's fun for me because Marcus Garvey, as you might know, was born in 1887. He was born in the St. Anne's Parish in Jamaica. My ancestors, 100 years before, were born and living in St. Anne's Parish, Jamaica.
Interesting.
So I have a tremendous connection to that. And it's always interesting for me because coming from little old Rhode Island, sometimes black folks will challenge me saying, well, there can't be any black history. You're from Rhode Island. You need to come from Georgia. You need to come from Mississippi. And I have to remind them that us black folks were doing things in Rhode Island before there was a Georgia and a Mississippi.
Yeah. I have a couple guests here, Bill, while he's directing my play, Catch the Tiger, by Marcus Garvey and J. Edgar Hoover. He has questions or comments for you, and Pauletta, playwright. Bill.
Yeah, one of my interests is from about 1890 to maybe about 1940, where there was a migration of blacks to northern climes, and there was a development of some sort of intellectual thought and a connection between black people. They begin to have different views about how black emancipation should go. Did you find anything like that in your part of the world?
Oh, yes, yes. In fact, we have a lot of information on that. At the end of the 19th and early 20th century, in fact, my wife and I just completed a project where we developed a history program called Gilded Age in Color. And it really traces black intellectuals here in New England that were actually meeting in designing and developing programs of self-betterment. But what's more important, and we think even more exciting, the very beginning of black recognition of a shared diaspora and a shared interest begins back here in Newport in the 1780s with the African Union Society. In fact, in 1787, and we have the original letter, the president of the African Union Society at that time, a man named Anthony Taylor, who's buried in our African cemetery, he sends a letter out to other African societies in Boston, in Philadelphia, New York, asking them, would they come together with Newport and help raise money so they could have a return to Africa. And in fact, their goal was to return to what would become Liberia. Now, this is 1787. This is nearly 30 years before the American Colonization Society is established. Liberia is not even established. But these Africans are already thinking about unifying, organizing, raising money, and going back to Africa. Now, what's interesting is the Philadelphia Africans disagree. It's being led by, at the time, Richard Allen, the founder of the Mother Bethel AME Church, Absalom Jones, who's the founder of the St. Thomas Episcopal Church, two of the earliest African-American churches in America. Their sense is, we don't want to go back to Africa. We're born here. Our future is to fight for having an organized church and fight for our civil rights. They also send a letter and a correspondence to Prince Hall in Boston. As you know, Prince Hall is the founder of the Prince Hall, the Masonic, the Black Mason's Order. Prince Hall also disagrees and says, no, I think we'll stay. Our future is organizing around Masons and civic organizations. So the Newport group's kind of left alone, and they spend the next number of years raising money, and in 1826, 24 of them return to Liberia. They're led by an African man named Nupumar Meraku. He's 84 years old. He was born in Africa. He was stolen away and brought to Newport at the age of 10. And here at the age of 84, he and this group return. What's unfortunate is that they all die of coastal fever within a year. Mm-hmm. What's most important is they died free men in their own land. So what's important to recognize is the early origins of black civil rights, black organization, black identity, black self-help, that was happening here in New England in the 18th century by Africans, and then later they would evolve into African Americans. Mm. So for me, when I see the great works of a Marcus Garvey, a Martin Luther King, a Harriet Tubman, Malcolm X, I mean, all of those men and women were influenced by Africans before them. Mm-hmm. And we know that because we have their writings, we have their information. And those were universally read, particularly in the back churches, in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Well, let me ask you this. How did David Walker and his David Walker appeal in 1829 fit in? Did that
well,
have
it's
much-
important. I mean, he's one of many. As William Still and James Fortin in Philadelphia, there were a number of African-American men and women, you know, in the mid, by the early mid-19th century, were doing everything in their power, one, to tell the true story of African enslavement, the horrors of it, the brutality of it, but two, were also looking to set the stage that eventually, at some time, be it through a civil war or a civil rights act, we are going to be free.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, today we see it as the abolitionist movement, but sometimes there's too much of a focus on the white abolitionists. It's not that they weren't dedicated and they didn't contribute, but it's the David Walkers. It's certainly one of my favorite books, and I think one of the most underrepresented books of that time, is My Life, you know, as a Slave, by written by Harriet Jacobs, an African-American woman, in 1861, which is one of the most harrowing experiences of being both black and a woman in the slave system and how she was able to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So my point being is that for me, I want to be able to tell the factual history of Africans in America, but I want to tell it from an African-American perspective. We weren't just passive, you know, watching history go by. We were shaping history. We were making heroic efforts, either as organizations or as individuals. And I think that's one of the most important aspects of African-American history that needs to be told today, possibly more today than ever, with what we see that's going on with our young people in a Ferguson or in a Charleston, South Carolina, or a New York, or a Baltimore.
Exactly. Paulina, you have...
Hi, Mr. Stokes. How are you doing?
Very good.
We met over the Internet. Sometimes at work, I just click buttons, and that's how I discovered you. But I didn't know you had already been discovered. So I was late to the game. But I really, because of listening to your lectures on YouTube, it inspired me to do some research about my family. My mother's family is from Geneva, New York. And just 2 days ago, I put my grandmother's name in Google search, and I put Paula Moore, Geneva, New York. And up came a book by Catherine Grover. She's a historian, and she lives in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
That's near me.
Right, and she wrote a book about the African Americans that lived in this white town of Geneva, New York, from the 1700s, from the 1790s to the present day. And she wrote about my family. My family's in her book. So I just ordered the book. I haven't received it yet, so it means I haven't read it. But I've been in contact with the author. I sent her an email. Like, I sent you the email. I sent her an email, and she responded back. And so she's very enthusiastic about helping me put that part of my family together. But I did some research, and I found out that about 25% of the maritime industry was manned by Africans in the early part. They were working the ships. They were very involved in that economy. And I didn't know that. I mean, there are things that we just weren't taught in school, and it's unfortunate that we were so involved in. We weren't just picking cotton, is what I want to say. And not that there's anything wrong with that, you know, because I think that we've also stigmatized a lot of things that are associated with being enslaved. And, you know, and I think that's part of it, that we have to embrace all of it. And see, like you said, I find that, you know, listening to your lecture, it helped me to see, or it sort of emphasized that there's beauty in this, that there was beauty in the enslavement, that these men and women didn't just sit back and be acted upon, that they actually did organize, they did try to escape. But I also learned that since listening to your lectures, that it was a lot of people wanted to come to. A lot of the Africans got word, and it's funny how word spread amongst the Africans, the enslaved Africans, that there were certain places in America, in the colonies, where it was a little, I would say the word friendly towards the enslaved African, that you had a better chance of survival, that you weren't as brutalized as you might have been in other places, or that you had more freedom, you weren't as restricted. Mm-hmm. Is that true in Rhode Island?
It's always hard. I mean, first of all, congratulations on your genealogical search. I think that's great. I come across people of African heritage almost every day who are discovering their roots, who thought they couldn't trace themselves back, they didn't know, and now they're finding their roots, and they're finding that they're as deep as yours, going back to the 18th and even 17th century. Several points I think is important. I did a blog story about a year ago about what was called African privateers and sailors, and what we found is that not only in Rhode Island, but all across New England in the 18th century, a significant percentage of the crews of privateers, whalers, merchant ships were Africans. Remember, much of the trade at that time was a part of the transatlantic trade. They were running from Europe to Africa to the West Indies to the American continent. So there was always a large percentage. And in fact, what I found going through runaway ads was this very peculiar circumstance. Many Africans that would run away would run to port communities like New Bedford, Newport, Boston. And the reason they did that is that they would literally hide in plain sight. They would run away from a farm or a plantation in one location, and then they would sign on for a privateer or a whaling vessel, and then who really didn't care as long as they had a warm body and a stout heart, and they would sign them on. And what I was finding was hundreds and hundreds of runaway slave ads in New England where the ads actually said, be on the watch for a runaway slave. We think he's signed on to a whaling vessel. We think he's a good sailor. So we do find many, many of these Africans, later African-Americans, serving on these ships. In fact, in the War of 1812, again, I'm very proud of this, the Battle of Lake Erie, the American fleet is commanded by a Newporter from Rhode Island, Oliver Hazard Perry, and a significant percentage of his crew are Africans from New England, even in Newport. So I think the other way to look at it, and I think this is an important aspect, when you look from the standpoint that between 1500 to about 1850, that 350-year period of slavery in the Western Hemisphere, there were about 12.5 million men, women, and children that came from Old World to New World. So when you think in terms of a 350-year period, all the people who left the Old World, I mean Dutch, English, French, Portuguese, Spanish, you name it, and all the places that they settled in, North America, South America, the Caribbean, all the cities that they established, from Charleston, South Carolina, to Boston, Massachusetts, Bridgetown, Barbados, Nassau, Bahamas, there's about 12.5 million people. Out of that 12.5 million that would come, 10 million were African men, women, and children as slaves.
Wow.
So just by the sheer numbers, the demographics, most of the people who eventually settled and lived and worked and worshipped and eventually died in the New World were as much African as any other group. Mm-hmm. But we don't know that today because it's been whitewashed. It's been taken away.
Exactly.
In fact, I have a lot of African-American associates who will talk in terms of, well, my background is Indian. It seems like every black friend I have has an Indian background. Well, exactly. DNA is now finding that that's not accurate.
Right. Yeah.
What DNA is finding is that you have solid African background, be it from West Africa or Central Africa or some combination, and then you might have some European mixture, but very little Indian. Because we know many of the native people, unfortunately, were not resistant to the disease that was brought by the Europeans as a part of their settlement.
Mm-hmm.
So for the most part, much of what is the Western Hemisphere, our culture, our language, our dance, our music, where does rap music come from? It's West, mm-hmm. West African tribal dance. So most of what is the Americas has as much an African influence as any other race or ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know that, and we don't allow ourselves to learn that. And I think that's what's the most important part of our research. It's mm-hmm. that personal self-discovery for each of us, but it's also this sense that, you know, this is our country too. We have just as much a reason to succeed as any other group, because we were here as early as, and we participated in growing and building the society as much as any other group at any other time. And that's the facts.
Mm-hmm. And I have one more question for you, Keith, before I let you go. Very, very interesting conversation. But I want to ask you, I see where you was involved with the Chamber of Commerce back there in Rhode Island. I know they deal a lot with business. But can you tell me, what was Garvey, Marcus Garvey's contribution to black business thought?
Well, as I've always, you know, read and understood with Garvey, as a part of his kind of universal, you know, association movement, he was looking for black folks to invest in black folks. And one of the creative survival techniques that came out of Jim Crow and discrimination after World War II was the fact that we were able to build our own black business identities. And as you know, from Tulsa, Oklahoma to Harlem to Richmond, Virginia and the Jackson Ward, we had dozens of black business neighborhoods where the barbershops, if you wanted a haircut, you better go to a black barbershop.
Exactly. I mean, it's still true.
If you wanted your teeth pulled, you better find a black dentist. If you wanted to buy groceries, guess what? You better find a black grocer. So because of discrimination and Jim Crow and isolation, we took it upon ourselves to build our own industries and become self-sufficient. That's been lost over the years. And that's something that Marcus Garvey believed in. And I believe in that today. I think there's a balance. But I think it's absolutely important, you know, that we begin to reinvest in our own communities and our own selves. And to give you a very quick example of that from a historical perspective is that the one thing that black folks weren't able to do because of slavery and discrimination and racism up until the last 2 years was to own assets. It was very hard to own your own property, be it your own farm, your own home. It was very hard. And if you did own something, it was very hard later to get insurance because you were redlined. So it's only been in recent history, through civil rights laws and other enactments, that black folks have been able to own again. And I think that's absolutely essential because when you own something, you can pass it on to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
It gives them a head start. I'm fortunate because, you know, I have generations that owned and passed on and passed on. And the home that I live in, we're four generations in this home.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got kids that are kidding me now saying, well, Dad, we'll put you in the nursing home, but we'll take care of the house. And that's just a joke now. But you know what? They get to do that, just like I got to do it. And so I think it's absolutely essential that the one thing we learn through history and through really our African identity is ownership and mm-hmm. passing that ownership into the next generation. And that's what Marcus Garvey believed in.
Okay, I think Paulella had one more little quick question, and then we'll let you go.
I wanted to find out. Someone told me that during the Civil War, that one of the reasons for the Civil War that were precipitated was that there was a movement that they were going to enslave the poor whites. Do you know anything about that? Have you ever heard anything about that? I had someone who was a fellow playwright. He's writing a play about that, that whites becoming enslaved.
There was no need to enslave whites because there were 4 million African Americans who were enslaved by 1860. So I hear that all the time. In fact, I've heard stories even earlier in the 17th century of indentured Irish servants, and there have been books written about Irish as slaves. There is a very important difference between indentured service and slavery. And there's a very important difference between African enslavement as compared to any enslavement in world history. Mm-hmm. In indentured service, you serve a period of time, normally until you're 18 as a female and 21 as a male, then you're free.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Africans never had that opportunity or choice. And in fact, one of the things that separates African slavery as compared to any other time in world history, be it the Egyptians enslaving the Jews or medieval slavery, African slavery was the first time in world history where slavery was based on race and based on an inheritable condition, meaning if your mother was a slave, you were born a slave. That's okay. What separated the African slave trade and African slavery compared to any other time in world history, and it sustained itself. And mm-hmm. guess what? When America abolished the trade by the early 19th century, what did the American South do? They created their future slaves by breeding them because it was inheritable.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very important to understand that there are those that would like to minimize the history of African enslavement by comparing it to other circumstances or conditions, and you cannot. It is a unique event in world history that had worldwide impacts on all people and all institutions, particularly the Africans themselves.
And
I think we sell ourselves short and we sell history short if we try to minimize the enslavement of Africans.
Mm-hmm. It was also a deliberate idea developed by Europeans to justify their conquests.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely. I tend to call it the European slave trade and not the African slave trade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Africans are the byproduct of it. It was a European generated system and profited system.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they tried to have a basis for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Keith, can you give us your contact information for those who want to contact you and for those that want to check out all of those great videos and books that you have?
Oh, please do. It's the website we've created is simply colonialcemetery.com, and that'll take you into the African cemetery, but it also has links to three or four other websites that we have, from the Gilded Age to the Civil War era, and we have all contact information through those websites, and people feel free to call and contact us, and we do lectures all around the country.
Okay. Keith Stokes, thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Sometime tomorrow, we probably send you a copy of the link to the show.
I look forward to it. And if you ever come this way to the East Coast, please look us up. We'd love to give you a tour of our city and our heritage sites.
Okay.
We're coming.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good night.
Right. Okay, let's take a break for our community calendar, and then we'll come back for our roundtable discussion.
This is a community calendar of upcoming events. Wednesday, August the 19th, 2015, from 5:30 to 8 p.m., Drama Stage Veterans Theater Workshop presents a 10-week free training for veterans and non-veterans in theater arts, stage management, lighting, sound, costume, and how to set up anti-violent situation coping groups, which is a conflict resolution. This is every Wednesday from 5:30 to 8 p.m., beginning August the 19th from 5:30 to 8 p.m. The location is 2341 East Olympic Boulevard. This is at the corner of Olympic and Santa Fe. And this is at the Vortex. Parking at the northeast corner of Santa Fe and Porter Street. Also, the Metro bus number 60 and 66 stops right at the corner. Sunday, August 23rd, 2015 at 2 p.m., Drama Stage Coom 1, L.A. Labor Fest, and Public Work Improvisational Theater presents A Reader's Theater, a performance of If the Shoe Fits. The location of the event will be KPFK, 3729 Cahuenga Boulevard West, Studio City, California, 91604. This is a free event. All are welcome to attend. This is part of a call to stop the torture, with events being held on the 23rd of each month. And this is signifying the number of hours prisoners are held in solitary confinement. And this is at Sunday, August 23rd, 2015 at 2 p.m. For more information, please call 310-704-3217 or email lalaborfest@gmail.com. Sunday, August 30th, 2015, from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m., Industrial Green will be holding its first annual summer fundraising. The location is Lot 613 Imperial. This is a family-friendly event. There will be food, drinks, music, display of current and future projects, and much more. For more information, contact industrialdistrictgreen.org. This is a Catherine McNinney project. If you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com. Attention, Earlene Anthony. Now back to our host.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Earlene Anthony. We're winding down. Also joining us for the roundtable is Michelle Autry, who's in the studio with us. And before we close out, our closing comments, I want to be sure that Pauletta gives us some information about her play that's being performed in Louisiana, And Bill will give us some information about the play that he's directing and when it will open. But first, I want to get into a discussion of Marcus Garvey. I think we're going to pass up the tape. We're going to pass up the clip that we had of Marcus Garvey. And then we're going to get right into our discussion. I want to go around the table. What did Marcus Garvey mean to you for this day and age? Let's start with Bill.
Well, Marcus Garvey means the first time that a black leader was able to look at Africans as African, that we're the same people, we're beautiful, we're wonderful, we have the same kind of brain, some of us are better than others, and we should really support ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that you cannot support other people, but we need to begin looking closer at who we sell things to and who we buy from.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Pauletta.
What I like about Marcus Garvey, I like the pageantry of Marcus Garvey.
Mm-hmm.
I think he made black people beautiful before you ever had that mantra, black is beautiful. I think he wasn't just into lip service, but he was into being that concept. You know, I think a lot of times, I read a couple of weeks ago, this writer said that we've replaced activism that we had in the 60s with a lot of academic discussions. And not a lot of things have come out of that. You know, it's easy to sit around and talk about philosophies and methodologies, but it's another to take it to the street. And mm-hmm. Marcus Garvey was sort of a, you know, like, I live in South Central. I mean, I grew up in South Central, and I still live in a black neighborhood. And, you know, I'm so accustomed to seeing black people, you know, black evangelists standing on the corner, you know, with their microphones and, you know, and a wooden cross and just, and not embarrassed, not ashamed, and proclaiming, you know, the way of the Lord. You know, I mean, just accustomed to that. And Marcus Garvey was that kind of person, you know, mm-hmm. that before he had millions of followers, he was on street corners speaking to one or two men at mm-hmm. a time. And I really liked that about him. Mm-hmm. He was inspired, he was inspirational, and he was into the beauty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had the feathers and the beautiful uniforms. And I was just really impressed with that. Like, where did he get, who was making these uniforms? And I'm sure they were black people. And they looked like it was good quality fabric. You know, I'm looking at it aesthetically. I'm like, back in the old days, they really looked good. You know, I'm sure they didn't have as much money as we have now. You know, I'm just from what I've read, but they yeah. looked good back then. It's you know, they didn't go out the house looking bad. They always looked really beautiful.
Okay. Michelle.
Well, thank you so much for letting me comment.
That's beautiful. That's
it great. Was. Apologize for my lateness. I think it's all of that. And having had the pleasure and the honor of being a part of the UNIA and planning the Marcus Garvey celebration for many, many years here in mm-hmm. Los Angeles with Sister Kaylee and mm-hmm. Brothers Johnson. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, the Freeman brothers, and God bless, God rest their souls. What really impressed me is his self-preservation in eliminating the slave mentality and bringing back recognition, you know, that we have a nation of origin, because that is what really Willie Lynch uprooted and undermined. Because if a people don't have a history, don't know about their history and the wealth that our history affords, then how can we move forward in any type of unified, you know, successful effort? So I appreciate his bringing back our self-preservation. Every other race comes to this country immediately. They organize in their own communities and develop their own businesses. But because of a slave mentality, even to this day, African-American people and black people are challenged. And Marcus Garvey hit that head on, you know your history. And he lived that, and I think he personified that in trying to establish the Black Star Fleet and also his many endeavors in the community to unify and give us, again, that sense of recognition of origin and that self-preservation, do for self, mm-hmm. One nation, one God, one aim.
Okay.
And I just am trying to okay. move yeah. forward at that as well.
You mentioned something that when Bob Marley says, emancipate yourself from mental slavery, none but ourselves can free our minds. Mm. That was Marcus Garvey's.
It's a quote from
Marcus Garvey.
Comes straight from Garvey.
Yeah.
Earlene, do you?
Marcus Garvey, I just learned about him when you started on the play. I didn't know much about Marcus Garvey, but I got much knowledge as she wrote the play, and we did the play a few times. But anyway, I think Marcus Garvey was one of those people that had a vision. And when a person has a vision, they are driven. And there are always people that along the way will catch on to that vision. Everybody is not going to have the same vision or agree with him, but there's always a little nucleus of people that are in the way that's going to help you get to where you have to go. And many times, even though the vision is not completed, say in his lifetime, he had the vision to run with it as far as he could go with it. And I believe that Marcus Garvey was one of those men.
Okay. Bill, won't you give us some information about Catch the Tiger? When is it coming?
Well, Catch the Tiger opens, we have previews on October 8th at 8 o'clock at Moments Playhouse Theater. It's on 665 North Heliotrope Drive in Los Angeles. That's just off Melrose between Normandy and Vermont. We actually open on October the 10th, and we run for 6 weeks, each Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Mm-hmm. Friday and Saturday is 8 o'clock, and the Sunday performance is at 3 p.m.
Okay. And contact information, that want to contact you about it?
Yes, the theater is 323-844-1466, mm-hmm. or they can contact me at Talawah65. TALAWAH65@yahoo.com.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about your play, real quick, your play, name of it, where it would
be. Adolfo Lizette Malvo, and I have to, again, thank you for asking me to have you hosted a reading for this play mm-hmm. about almost 3 years ago, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it was only a 10-minute play, and when you came and asked me to do the reading, it made me have to write another maybe 40 minutes. So it started from a 10-minute play, and now I have a full, it's a full two-act play. Mm-hmm. And it was submitted to the Upstage Theater in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Dr. Ava Turner is the artistic director of that theater. And the play was submitted to her about a year and a half ago, maybe almost 2 years ago. And, I never really heard anything back from her. So, you just keep writing. And about a month and a half ago, I started getting this strange phone number on my phone. And I wasn't going to answer the phone. I thought it was maybe a telemarketer or something. Mm-hmm. So something is, I know it was the Lord, inspired me to check my voicemails a Thursday night, like about midnight. And she was sending me all of these SOS calls. Please give me a call. Please call me. We want to consider your play. I'm meeting with the other board members Friday at 1 o'clock. So I was able to get it submitted, and it was chosen.
Okay, give us a name and when it's being performed.
Adolfo Lizette Malvo will be at the Upstage Theater in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, October 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. That's a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Friday and Saturday at 8 o'clock and Sunday at 3 o'clock p.m.
Okay. I have to close this out, and we also leave, we got a little section called the Lazarus Book Club to help wake the dead. This week, the book I'm going to recommend is called Black Africa, The Economic and Cultural Basis for a Federated State by Sheikh Anta Diop, C-H-E-I-K-A-A-N-T-A. D-I-O-P, one of your top African scholars, world scholars. Please listen to past shows of the Qumran Report by Googling in Qumran Report. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, my co-host, Earlene Anthony. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. I leave you with Sunji Ali, Homeboy.
'cause there ain't no sense in us trampling on the stones. It's us.